Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. This is the week that American trade partners began retaliating against tariffs on steel and aluminum imported to the United States. Canada started collecting tariffs on products including orange juice, yogurt, whiskey, maple syrup, and soups. Mexico and China will soon start collecting new tariffs on U.S. pork and dairy products. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which often supports Republican economic policies, has been outspoken against the tariffs. But a recent survey by Bucknell University's Institute for Public Policy finds Trump's voters in six key states, including Pennsylvania, are skeptical of free trade and don't believe it helps the economy. To tell us more about the survey is Chris Ellis, a political science professor and director of the Bucknell Survey Research Laboratory. Professor Ellis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in on trade, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Professor Ellis, the big takeaway for you from this poll.
Yeah, so in looking at this, what we found was that while trade tariffs are probably a loser nationally, right, that people aren't really excited about what they're going to do, they're skeptical of their effects, they tend to be more popular in states that are key to Trump, right? So the six states that you mentioned that he flipped to he flipped from Barack Obama to win the 2016 election are more skeptical of trade agreements and the idea of trade generally than states that either voted for Democrats twice or that voted for Republicans twice. So while this may not play well sort of nationally, it seems to be a big deal in the states that Trump counted on.
Those six states, Pennsylvania, as I mentioned, is one of them. What are the other five states?
Ohio, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa. So those were the six that flipped in the 2016 election.
For the most part, other than Florida, old Rust Belt states.
Yeah. Although we were surprised that Florida looked a lot like these other states in terms of their views on trade. But yeah, mostly the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk percentages and pessimistic in what way? I think that's the word you used in the poll, that the people we ask about this were pessimistic about the benefits of free trade.
Yeah, there seemed to be broad consensus that trade helps consumers, right, which is also the one broad consensus among economists, that it brings prices down and more choice and things like that. But in terms of other aspects of the U.S. economy, whether it's just sort of overall economic growth or employment prospects or wages of people like you and people around you, this is where we saw this big divide between the Obama-Trump states, we'll call them, and everyone else. So the country is pretty divided on, for example, whether trade helps employment, right? We have about half the country saying yes, about half the country saying no. But if you look at the Obama-Trump states, that number goes up to about two-thirds that say it has a negative impact on employment. So we're seeing people, for whatever reason, start to look at these issues differently in some of these key, again, mostly Midwest Rust Belt states, thinking that, look, maybe, you know, tariffs aren't the best option, but what's happening now isn't really working either.
Did you ask about tariffs?
We didn't ask about tariffs specifically. We've seen from some other surveys, I don't have the state-by-state breakdowns, but other state surveys that people have done, the tariffs, again, are sort of not real popular nationally, but if we look at the workers that might be, you know, might have been hurt by trade before, we see them much more popular. Now, these could be, you know, ironically enough, the workers that will be hurt by the tariffs. But, yeah, again, sort of trade is much more popular among people sort of doing well economically.
Yeah, and as you just mentioned, there are workers who were Trump supporters, probably still are in many cases, maybe even most cases. It's hard to tell since we don't have another election for 2 years. But let me put it this way. I'm curious as to their attitudes toward the administration, even though you didn't ask about tariffs, toward the administration, toward the president, and, you know, talking about getting rid of NAFTA, getting out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that these seem to be issues that went over well with those voters.
Yeah, so this will be interesting to see how this plays out. So the reason trade, or one of the reasons I think trade protectionism went over well with these voters, is because they got to see the losers of trade, right? That everyone gets to see the lower prices and the more choice at the market, but they're the ones that got to see the mill gone and the neighbor lose their job and things like that. Now the tariffs might do the same thing. We saw that Harley-Davidson is shifting some production overseas. And it's you know, really no accident. You mentioned pork and dairy. It's really no accident that a lot of these tariffs are targeting these kinds of states. That maybe if these start to have those kinds of concentrated negative effects, opinion might flip. It hasn't yet, but it'll probably take a couple months for all this to sort of work its way through the economy, especially if we do go into this big trade war situation.
Well, you know, what you mentioned earlier, it will come as no surprise that the poll found that Republicans and Democrats viewed trade much differently. In what ways?
Yeah, so this is where I think Trump sort of made headway with working class voters, particularly working class Republicans, in that he talked about trade almost entirely from the standpoint of winning, right? What does this do for us, and what do tariffs or renegotiated agreements do for us? And that fits with what Republicans, by and large, think trade should be, right? That we should care about whether it benefits the U.S. economy, and we should care about whether it benefits U.S. workers, and that's it. And so I think that that message sort of resonated with people who also believe that. On the Democratic side, we see that that stuff isn't unimportant, but we see they care about other things, too. They care about things like human rights standards with who we trade with, and environmental standards of who we trade with, and things like health and safety. So it's sort of a much broader and kind of maybe harder to follow argument than, look, we just want to make the U.S. economy better. And so Republicans are sort of laser-like focused on that, and Democrats sort of take a maybe broader-like approach.
Well, let me just quote from the poll. Said Republicans more likely to prioritize the interest of American consumers and workers, with 73% responding that effects on working-class Americans should be very important priority when setting trade policy, compared to 61% of Democrats, 62% of independents. 71% of Republicans thought impacts on American consumers were an important priority, compared with 60% of Democrats, 61% of independents. And as you said, that the Republicans seem to have their priorities as consumer prices, American workers, where Democrats were thinking about, I think is what you said, thinking more globally about the impact on trading partners. That would seem to be a winning political formula for Trump voters, for Republican voters who support the president.
Yeah, I think it is. Now, some of them might be sort of taking their cues from the president. But yeah, I mean, I think his message on trade was very clear and very simple, right, that our trade agreements are hurting us. Now, whether that is true or not, but it was very, very straightforward and said, look, if we're going to make these better, we're going to do it in a way that makes them better for U.S. workers. And so, you know, we can debate whether his policies will actually do that, but if that's the message, then it's certainly a winning message.
You know, what I kind of compare this to when I saw the results was I thought of Walmart.
Okay.
I may be going off track here a little bit.
No, it's good.
But, you know, the world's largest retailer, and many people criticize Walmart for low prices, the wages that they pay their workers, that kind of thing. But yet there's a reason it is the world's largest retailer, is that Americans in particular enjoy the benefit of lower prices. And this is what this kind of reminded me of. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and there's lots of studies that sort of suggest this, that Walmart has been one of the biggest, provided one of the biggest benefits to U.S. consumers of any business, right? Because, you know, you see this in all different ways, but prices go down, you can get stuff in season that you couldn't get in season anymore. So from the consumer perspective, Walmart's fantastic, right? Now, obviously, there's the other side of that, is what does it do to local businesses and things like that? So it sort of depends on what you've seen and where you are in your society. Again, the sort of issue with Walmart, though, is that, you know, Walmart's prices go down a little bit, or they make things a little bit more affordable, and that's sort of hard to see right in front of your face because it sort of happens subtly. It happens to everybody. But if, you know, the local store that's been in business for 30 years closes down because there's a new Walmart down the street, then that's a whole different deal, right? And so, yeah, if you look at Walmart, I think that sort of reflects, I mean, it's a good example of sort of reflecting the ambivalence we have about this. On one hand, you know, we shop there all the time because they offer better prices and better selection, but at the same time, there's been these other runoff effects that we've had to deal with.
Let's take a phone call from Leon in Lancaster. Leon, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I have maybe a comment, and maybe you can follow up on it. Most people, you know, have been believe free trade certainly is good for both economies. However, it's based on the idea of comparative advantage. And what has subsequently happened, probably since the 90s, is with corporations moving offshore, we've essentially given these countries, especially China, the comparative advantage. And they build not for their economies, which is classic, you know, export theory. You indeed, after you export, you build just like Harley is in Europe. That's what they should do. But they build for their own economy and sell there, not sell back. So essentially, the free trade you're talking about isn't really fear-free. We've given them the comparative advantage by giving them our factories. And then they sell them back in the United States. And that's a common thing. I mean, if you're a business owner and you want to produce something, you can job it over in China and get it shipped back here. And you know, you're basically trading labor rates. Mm. Just your comment. And I know this to be a fact, okay, because I'm a 30-year financial executive in multinational companies. And I just thought I'd throw that out.
All right. Hey, Leon, thank you very much for your call. Professor Ellis, what about that? I mean, and I think one of the big points he's making is the definition of free trade.
Yeah, so that comment sort of illustrates why economists love trade for forever and why we're now starting to become a little bit more skeptical. So we are giving China does have comparative advantage in lots of different ways, and that sort of benefits their workforce. It adds jobs over there, but it also benefits American consumers, because if it costs obviously less for a product to be produced, then it's going to cost less when you buy it. Two things that have started to worry people that sort of came out of that comment. One, it used to just be sort of manufacturing and textiles and things like that where China had this comparative advantage. But now we're starting to see it slip into other aspects of the economy, right? Making electronics, designing electronics, nuclear power, solar power. So the concern is what's left, right? That if you know, we only have advantage in only certain areas of the economy, then what's left for American workers to do? And so that's one thing. The second part of it is, well, we can, you know, worry about the prices angle, and I think even now the evidence is still pretty clear that a trade deficit with China benefits American consumers. But what does that mean when consumers aren't making the wages that they used to, right? And so that's why for years and years and years, economists thought that the trade was unequivocally good, because if two countries want to engage in an agreement and there's a law stopping it, then the law shouldn't exist. But now we're starting to see that there also could be people hurt by that, and hurt in very targeted ways. And sort of what do we do with that, especially as the trade deficit grows and as China sort of expands the kind of things it can do better or at least as well as the United States. Well, so yeah, a lot of stuff there, right? And so this is what makes this all complicated. The other thing about China right now is, as the caller sort of mentioned, right, our trade deficit there is pretty substantial, right? We're trading about a quarter of the amount of stuff to them that they sell to us. And so when China places retaliatory tariffs on the United States, there's only so much they can do, because there's only so much they buy from us. And so if they want to retaliate, we're sort of getting to the point where they might have to do other things, like target American companies working in China and things like that. And that's when stuff gets really dangerous, because then if we can't do business over there, then a whole bunch of other things happen as well.
I want to talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about free trade and actually a poll conducted by Bucknell University. Our guest is Chris Ellis, a political science professor and director of the Bucknell University Survey Research Laboratory. The big takeaway from this is six states that flipped from Barack Obama in 2012 to supporting President Trump in 2016 are generally skeptical of free trade, the benefits of free trade to the economy. Pennsylvania is one of those states. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
This is very interesting stuff. I don't think it's very surprising, but it's very interesting. This fits into what we hear about Trump's negotiating strategy. He's a real estate, his experience is in real estate, and his use seems to be that the only negotiation that works is what is called a zero-sum negotiation. In other words, if I win, you lose, and vice versa. Trade negotiations tend to be, at least what we hear from the experts, they tend to be, we both win. In other words, you talked earlier about comparative advantage, where you know, it's possible if the Chinese are better at one thing and we're better at something else, let's build the stuff that we're better at in America, and they can build the stuff that they're better off there, and we both win. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that President Trump understands that, and his supporters don't seem to understand that either, because it's frankly a rather sophisticated idea that it is possible in a negotiation for both people to win. Thanks very much.
All right, Jim. Well, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to follow up on that, but just get your response, Chris, as to what Jim had to say.
Yeah, that's the exact reason why economists love trade so much, used to love trade so much, is because it's the perfect example of a positive sum transaction, right? We each get something out of it that's better for us than if we wouldn't have made that transaction. And that's why tariffs are complicated, right? It would be an ideal world if you could place tariffs on somebody else's stuff and they wouldn't retaliate, but of course the world doesn't look that way. And so, you know, in the long run, this makes both of us better off. Now, to sort of be a little bit more generous to Trump, in that the positive sum is for both countries taken as a whole, right? The United States and China are both better off because we've been engaged in trade agreements for some time, the United States and Canada or whatever. That's not necessarily the case for everybody in the United States. And Trump, to the extent that he's, you know, or at least his advisors are thinking this through, might be saying, well, you know, it's great that we're a little bit richer, but at the same time, you know, what does that mean for the stereotypical mill worker in Michigan or something like that? And so how do we sort of balance those concerns? But you're right, right? As soon as you start, you know, placing tariffs on goods, right, that then, you know, the positive sum aspect of trade goes right out the window, and that's the main reason to have it.
But let me put something else out there in this discussion, and that is that even this is a poll when we're talking a lot about politics. For many people who maybe responded to this poll or even voted for President Trump, voted for President Obama in 2012, this is not necessarily a political issue as much as it's a personal issue, that they or someone they know has been impacted negatively. And you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. And that has an influence on how they think about free trade. That it is not just, these are just numbers. These are real people to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're probably making this too much about a Trump issue or a Trump versus Obama issue. But this is the American economy for the past 40 years, right? And so Trump is doing things a little differently, as he always does, but these trends didn't start with him and they won't end with him. And so, yeah, if you're looking at this not from a who do I want for president perspective, but, you know, I'm upset, so I'll try something different, I mean, that's sort of how Trump won in the first place. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is not people sort of parsing economic data and figuring out what trade does for consumers and the economy. This is, you know, I'm upset because I've seen the negative side of this.
And you mentioned, and I wanted to follow up on this a little bit, about why this is so complicated. In the poll, those people who said they were pessimistic about free trade in those six states, they mentioned economic growth, that free trade may not have a positive impact on economic growth, employment prospects, wages, and people like them. All right, and we can talk about the first three, but people like them, what's that mean?
Yeah, so that, I mean, and, it, you know, the wording on that's a little funky, but basically saying, look, if you think about, and what we know is people sort of think about their neighborhood, okay, whether it's, you know, the suburban school district or whether it's a rural town or whatever. And, yeah, that's where we see a lot of the biggest divides between low-income and higher-income people and between Obama-Trump states and the other states, is that people like them, for some people, can mean, you know, oh, we're all, you know, my tech company expanded because now we can sell more stuff to China. But for other people, that's a very different story. And so I think what people are doing here is at least in some basic way, sort of this cost-benefit analysis, right? That we're sort of saying, hey, look, yeah, I know products are a little bit cheaper, but does it matter if I can't buy them? And, you know, if that's your story, then obviously trade is going to be, you know, less of a automatically good thing for you. And you might sort of at least welcome the idea of tariffs, even if you don't know much about them, because, hey, it's at least different than what I've seen.
On this question, and again, most of the people who were surveyed were pessimistic about free trade in these areas, can understand employment prospects because they see a lot of these jobs that were good-paying jobs going to overseas. Wages, because same reason, that that's keeping wages down. But economic growth, why are they pessimistic that free trade does not have a positive impact on economic growth?
So this is something else that I think is really interesting, and this comes from a survey we did about a year ago. But what we know is when people think of economic growth, they're not thinking about the GDP number that just came out, because that's a number and can bear no relevance to their actual lives. So when people are sort of thinking about questions like this, they're thinking about their local economy. And what we found that I thought was pretty interesting is they're not thinking about how well their local economy is doing today, necessarily. They're thinking about how well their local economy is doing compared to, like, 10 years ago, right? Is the trajectory good or not? And for people who see that it's not, then that primes a whole lot of negative attitudes, not just towards trade, but towards immigration and towards, you know, politicians and all kinds of other stuff. Because it's not just, you know, I'm in a good or bad area, but I'm in a declining area, and that makes me upset about anything that sort of might be status quo-ish.
Is that a fair way to look at it, though? I mean, using your scenario of 10 years ago, things change, sometimes for the better, sometimes not.
And people are very attuned to whether it's getting better or worse, particularly if you've lived in a place for a while. And so, you know, you see low unemployment and you see, you know, decent wage growth and you see high economic growth over the past whatever couple of years, but that doesn't matter if you're not seeing it in your own community. And that's sort of what we found.
And that's what
people are much more attuned to what's going on around them than they are to any national statistic they might come across.
And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, that this in particular, probably more so than a lot of other political polls or polls looking at politics, people were looking at it from their own point of view and how they've been impacted and people around them have been impacted. Let's go to Les in Harrisburg. Les, you're on the air.
Thank you. And I'm on the road right now, so I can't look it up, but it seems to me there's a mention of tariffs or duties or imports in the Constitution. And I know that the Coast Guard used to be known in its early days as the Revenue Cutter Service because it collected duties. And I was wondering how is it mentioned in the Constitution? And if it is, why aren't we just following the basic Constitution?
Hey, thank you very much for your call. Chris Ellis, you aware of that?
So what we've seen from that is that, you know, there's been a couple court cases that have dealt with this. Their names are slipping my head right now. But the executive branch, led by the president, has been given pretty wide latitude under the Constitution to do basically what they want on trade. There's some people that have, you know, question whether it's really Trump's authority to do this or whether it lies to Congress, but those arguments haven't gotten too far. So, yeah, I mean, the president can sort of do what they want. They can, you know, direct the Coast Guard to do what they want. They can, you know, so they have pretty wide latitude to sort of set whatever policy they want to.
Well, and, you know, a little bit of history here, that the tariffs and duties, that was how the country paid its bills. That was all the money coming in, basically. I shouldn't say all the money, but most of the money coming into the country before an income tax came from tariffs and duties.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the broad sweep of history, this is relatively new. I mean, there was stuff before NAFTA, obviously, but that was really the game changer, right? Because that was the template for negotiating agreements with all sorts of other countries, and it's sort of, you know, we talk a lot about China, but Mexico and Canada are as big a trade partner as China is. And so we've seen, you know, all sorts of things happen in the past 30 years, and, you know, when things happen that quickly, that does stuff to economies. That it takes a while to sort of fully work in and process. And I think part of what we're seeing in this survey is that now, right? Okay, this has been going on for a while. Our lives have changed. I'm not sure they've changed for the better. So what does that mean for me, and what does that mean for what the country should do?
Let's go to Mike in Hummelstown. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is this, or comment. Years ago, when we started, well, Trump tends to blame previous administrations on, you know, the trade we have with China and the trade imbalance. But really, doesn't it boil down to the fact that many years ago, you know, Walmart started buying things from China, and many companies started investing to have their products manufactured in China for the low wages? And was it truly driven by previous reasons, or was it driven by the business world?
Thank you very much for your call. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, the business world has obviously wanted this for quite some time. Politically, it was harder to do until we started signing these kinds of agreements. And trade, for better or worse, for you know, at least the past 30 years, has been one of the very few bipartisan or close to bipartisan issues we've had, right, where at least centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans, you know, basically agreed that trade was good and we should sign these agreements. I mean, Bill Clinton negotiated NAFTA, obviously. George W. Bush added on to that. Barack Obama added on to that. So this has not been the fight that we've seen on nearly any other issue. So, yeah, I mean, it's sort of the actions of administrations, but then certainly once that you know, ban on trade or sort of tariffs on trade are lifted, then everyone's going to sort of swoon in and take advantage of it to the best of their ability, right? Everyone from Walmart to Apple to anyone else.
I think Mike's point, though, is that this has not been these trade deficits have not necessarily been driven by our leaders in Washington. For the most part, it has been decisions made on the corporate level as to relocating to overseas and the wages that they're paying their workers, which in turn leads to lower prices for consumers here in the U.S. That's what has driven a lot of this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, because, you know, countries don't trade, really. Companies trade. But when you're sort of signing these agreements, obviously, you sort of do that with that knowledge in the back of your mind, right? You sort of know the kind of wages that China pays. You sort of know what Walmart wants to do or whoever wants to do once an agreement's signed, and you sort of do that knowing that's what's going to happen. But certainly it's been, you know, we can talk about lobbying and all that other stuff, but certainly it's been, you know, a win for these kinds of companies because the laws allow them to do what they've wanted to do for some time before that.
So we only have a minute or so left, Professor Ellis. What does all this information that you've gathered, what does it mean going forward?
So the first place is in 2018, and so we'll get to see what happens in the midterms. I mean, this data sort of suggests that, you know, at least in some of the states like Pennsylvania where this is important, there are congressional districts that might be a little bit more skeptical of trade, even some of the suburban ones, than maybe you might think nationally. Now, we'll see what happens once the tariffs start working their way through. But maybe at least in the states that matter to Trump or some of the districts that matter to Trump, trade isn't, these tariffs aren't going to be a political loser. As we go forward, right now we're doing stuff differently, right? That Clinton, Bush, Obama weren't as aggressive in their talk, weren't as aggressive in their tariffs or retaliatory tariffs or whatever. So now we're doing things differently, and it'll be interesting, at least, to sort of see if this discussion gets flipped on its ear, because for decades there's been this sort of centrist consensus. I mean, the far left and far right have been opposed, but this kind of centrist consensus that trade is good and we should do more of it. And now that Trump, it's like so many other things, has sort of come in and stirred the pot a little bit, we'll see if that kind of consensus holds or whether we start to look at this issue a little bit differently. And if we do, we also have data that suggests that Democrats and Republicans might look at what trade's all about a little bit differently. So, no crystal ball, but if the discussion is changing, then certainly I think we can say that it'll change differently for people in these key states than it will for others.
Chris Ellis is a political science professor and director of Bucknell University Survey Research Laboratory. Chris, always good talking to you.
Yeah, it's fun. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Congressional redistricting has been one of the nation's hot-button issues this year. Many expected the U.S. Supreme Court to settle a few questions about whether districts in three states were gerrymandered to give one political party an advantage over another, but the court sent two of the cases back to lower courts, so the questions are still kind of up in the air. Joining us now is former Pennsylvania State Senator Franklin Currie, author of the new book, Gerrymandering, A Guide to Congressional Redistricting, Districting, Dark Money, and the Supreme Court. Senator Currie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I always ask this question. Why did you write this book?
I wrote it because the subject has greatly intrigued me. The question of gerrymandering goes to the very essence of our democracy. The whole idea of representative government is based on the idea that it's going to be fair representation, that everybody's viewpoint will have some consideration. And that is what is lost by gerrymandering. By excessively partisan gerrymandering, the people on the left or the right that are not involved with the base that has been put together don't have any impact, and the people elected don't have to pay any attention to them. And that sours our democracy. So what we have in Congress today is a small group of hardcore right-wing Tea Party types who are blocking everything. And they don't represent the people, but they block the people who do from doing it. So I wrote it because I think we need to get fair representation and make congressional districts competitive.
In looking at the book, it seems to be an educational tool. What do you want to, first of all, would you agree with that? And secondly, what do you want to impart in the book to those who would be reading it?
Well, yes, it is an educational tool. In the book, I tried very hard to give, first of all, I start off with an anatomy of what a bad gerrymandering case is, which is Pennsylvania. Then I go to a history of gerrymandering in the United States. And then I go to the difficulties in trying to change it through the state legislatures and then through the state courts. And the last part of the book is called A Citizen's Toolbox, where I have from the National Conference of State Legislatures information that will tell you what are the criteria for redistricting in your state. What states allow you to change it by a ballot box referendum? What states have congressional reapportionment commissions? The other thing I have in there is from the National Institute for Following State Money that shows how difficult it is to follow dark money, that is independent expenditures in state elections. It's a terrible mess. And then I also have other information there by which any citizen can better understand what it's like in their area, in their state. So, yes, it is aimed at public education. Now, what do I want to bring away? I want to bring away that change, reform is possible. It's a tough uphill fight, but it is possible. And people should carry on the fight to reform it.
You were, and probably still are, but when you were elected to office, to state office, you were a Democrat. Is this partisan? Do you have a partisan point of view here?
Not really. It's just that the Republicans have been better at it. Nothing they've done is illegal. It's not like they're committed crimes or anything like that. No, it's better. But they've been better at it. And they've played political hardball better than the Democrats have, at least in Pennsylvania. Now, in some states like Illinois and Maryland, the Democrats have done the reverse to the Republicans. So this book is really across party lines. It's not on one side or the other.
Now, you do mention, though, that you wrote about an anatomy of a gerrymander using Pennsylvania as an example. In what way?
Well, Pennsylvania had what was considered one of the most gerrymandered states in the United States. And that was because of the result of the 2011 redistricting, in which they wound up where the Republicans had 13 of 18 seats. And of those 18 seats, 12 or 13 win by 60% or more of the vote. Now, that's ridiculous. Governor Wolf beat Corbett by less than 1%. I think it was 51 to 49, something like that. And Trump beat his opponent, Hillary, by only 1%, 48 to 47. Yet in the congressional campaigns, they get 54% and get 72% of the Congress people. So it's terribly unfair.
Let me be skeptical for just a moment and, you know, push back what a skeptic would say to you. Because I've had people in this program who have said this, that the state is, you know, we have most of our Democratic voters in Philadelphia, Allegheny County, some parts of the Northeast, and the rest of the state is pretty rural and pretty solid Republican. So doesn't it make sense that there would be more Republican Congress people elected from those areas?
Well, it might be, but the question is, how competitive does a Democrat have a chance? Now, you say the mid-state is solidly Republican. I don't buy that at all. I was elected from the middle of the Republican district to the state Senate. Jill Ammerman was elected to congressman as congressman from Center County. We've had Democratic Congress people from York County. Tim Holden represented Dauphin County. Alan Ertl was elected from Lycoming County. The question is, how much of a chance does the other side have? So the parties running have to appeal to both sides and not just to a narrow base. That's the issue, and that's what we're trying to address here.
So when you're writing about the anatomy of how this gerrymander came about in Pennsylvania, how did it come about?
It came about through a very secret process. The Republican National Committee figured out, while the Democrats were sleeping, that the way to get control of the redistricting was to elect a majority of the state legislature. So they spent money through independent expenditures, dark money, and they elected two or three Republicans to the House that they had upset Democrats with this money, and they got control of the House, the Senate, and the governorship, and they had complete control to do what they wanted. They did it by a secret vote. And there were the whole program was, the whole plan was designed in secret, and it was revealed at the last minute. There were no public hearings, no input from anybody but the narrow group of people inside the closed doors. And that's how it happened. Now, this was perfectly legal. They didn't break any laws, but it sure didn't fare. And so that's what we're up against. And fortunately, the state Supreme Court said it was invalid under state constitutional law. So that will be in effect, the Supreme Court's order declaring it invalid with a new, and the state Supreme Court's put in a new plan, which will be in effect till 2020. But thereafter, the question is who will draw the boundary lines for the next district that will start with the 2021 census. And that's where what's going on in Harrisburg right now is very important. There is the state legislature retired for the summer, recessed for the summer without acting on Senate Bill 22, which had passed the Senate, which would create a commission to take it out of the hands of the legislature and put it in the hands of a commission with public hearings and all that kind of thing. But the House adjourned and didn't do anything about it. So I just hope that if anybody's concerned about this, they really want to change it, they should call the governor and ask him to bring the legislature back to session, and they should talk to the state legislature about returning to Harrisburg to get the work done.
And I want to compare eras. History is always important, and historical perspective is important. What you described with, and as you said, nothing illegal, but being done in secret, without the other party, the minority party, being consulted here, that happens on, I don't know if it happens, if many is an accurate word, but it happens with budgets, with a lot of other things. What's different than when you were in the legislature?
I don't think it was done in the secrecy that is done now. What's changed in the last 10 years particularly? First of all, you have computers. They have completely changed the whole idea of redistricting. You can put it into a computer program, which you can buy for $10,000. Any combination of factors that you think ought to affect it and draw lines, the computer does it. So it's done with the speed of lightning. It used to take a week or two or three. Now they can do it in a matter of minutes once they agree on what they want. Also, there's more money involved now. One of the big problems I've learned in researching this book is dark money. The Supreme Court Citizens United case allows wealthy people like the Koch brothers, and now there are some Democrats, but the people exceptionally wealthy can put money into nonprofit foundations and then spend it for political purposes as long as it's independent without disclosing who they're, what their identity or who they are. And this is under the Citizens United case. And independent means they don't coordinate with any state, with the candidates or the campaign committees. And this is what happened in 2010. They put all this money against these that these Democratic House members, but nobody knew where the money was coming from.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because as you refer to it as dark money, Citizens United did open a Pandora's box, in many people's opinion, because there isn't that transparency. You know, what a lot of people take away from it is that the Supreme Court ruled that a corporation, for example, has freedom of speech, and that they can, that's the basis for this, was a First Amendment argument. So that dark money, how would you define dark money?
Dark money is money spent for political purposes without revealing the identity of who's spending it.
Mm-hmm. So where is it coming from? I mean, you mentioned the Koch brothers. Yes, there are Democrats, Steyer in California, some others out there. George Soros is one that a lot of people point out to. So it's coming from both sides, but mostly Republican. So what would you advocate to, I mean, this is a Supreme Court ruling. It is the law of the land right now.
It is. I think it ought to be changed. I think all money should be disclosed as to who the donors are. And I think the Congress should change the Internal Revenue Code, because this is not done by General Motors or Campbell Soup or these kind of companies, the regular for-profit corporations. The money that the Koch brothers and others spend goes through 501c4. Now, I know most people won't know what that is, but that's a special category under the Internal Revenue Code where you get, where it's tax deductible. You can put money in there and spend it for proper educational purposes. Well, that's been expanded to include political purposes. That's where the money goes. They spend it, and nobody knows who's contributing to it. I think that is bad. Now, I talked to the people out in Helena, Montana, is the National Institute for Money and State Politics, and I talked to their executive director, and she told me that this is a mess. The states have no way of knowing who's spending this money on state elections. So, and one of the things in my book is that there's a map in the book that grades each state according to how good it is on requiring the reporting of independent expenditures. 26 states, including Pennsylvania, flunk. They get an F. And one of the things in the back of my book is how the Institute tabulated or determined those scores for each state. Now, this is a situation where legislators and citizens really should be up in arms. We want to know who's spending independent expenditures, and how are they expending it?
So would that come under the heading of campaign finance reform?
Yes.
And this isn't exactly an issue that gets the attention of voters.
No, it doesn't. For example, Scott, if you were going to run for Congress, I could send you a check for $100 to the Lamar for Congress campaign.
Wow, I never heard that before.
Well, this is hypothetical. Okay,
it is very hypothetical.
All right. You'd have to report that. I got $100 from Franklin Curry. Any candidate who gets this money's got it, or to your campaign committee. But if I spend it on my own without talking to you or your campaign, just put out an ad in the newspaper or send out letters, Scott Lamar is a great guy, or Scott Lamar's a thug. Either way, I don't have to disclose that. That's an independent expenditure. And that's where I think so much of this money is being spent. People don't know this, but they should.
So what would you advocate here in Pennsylvania?
I think we ought to have a much more comprehensive reporting requirement for independent expenditure. We ought to have who's spending it, why they're spending, for what purpose are they spending it? You know, you don't even know whether they're spending it for legislators or individual legislators or what the issue is. You don't know any of that. So I think they ought to make a much more comprehensive reporting requirement for those, particularly those from out of state. But it doesn't matter that whoever wants to do it, they should be required to report and disclose.
When I do hear about campaign finance reform being advocated here in Pennsylvania, it's usually coming from the media as far as in an editorial form. I'm trying to remember candidates talking about it. As I said, it doesn't seem to be an issue that is at the top of the list for voters. If a candidate was running on this, would they would there be people who would support them because of that issue, or people would oppose them because of that issue?
I don't know, but I think so. And I think it's about, I think people don't know about this issue. One of the reasons I hope my book will be read by a lot of people so they get the details on independent expenditures, because it's all laid out in the book. There's a there's a map which shows you how each state is scored. In fact, right there it is, Scott. I don't have my glasses. You can tell me what page it's on. But that tells you...
45.
On page 45, it shows you a map of how each state is scored for reporting independent expenditures. That's dark money. And in the back of the book, and the document H, it tells you how those scores were tabulated.
Well, I'm looking down here who gets A's and who gets F's. There are very, very few C's in here.
Yeah.
Looks like New Hampshire has a C. But looking at A's, Texas, Maine, Montana, Washington, California, Oregon, what are those states doing differently than Pennsylvania does?
Well, they require that anybody spending money for independent expenditures in their states has to file a report with the Election Bureau saying how much they're spending, why they're spending it, for what purpose, and so on. Much more complete reports. We have virtually nothing.
In the book, you also, it's right in the title, talk about the Supreme Court. You talk both about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling as far as redistricting goes, that really kind of was a game changer this year, but also the U.S. Supreme Court. The book was written, it was published before the Supreme Court of the United States decided to send those two cases back that many people were counting on to kind of provide some black and white here of where it is. And really what it did was, with sending those cases back to federal court, we're still in a gray area.
Well, let me, first of all, the issue with the federal Supreme Court was, how do you measure gerrymandering when it's excessive? How do you measure? And there was something called the efficiency gap that argued that if it was more than 77% efficiency gap, it was unconstitutional, et cetera. They never got to, that was never discussed in the opinion, so that the Supreme Court did nothing on that. So we don't know, that is as if nothing happened. But that's under the federal constitution and the 14th Amendment. But the state Supreme Court, under the state constitution, under the Free and Equal Elections Clause, said this congressional districting in Pennsylvania violated the state constitution because it was not free and equal. So they use the state's a criteria of compactness, contiguousness, and not breaking up communities to rewrite the plan for Pennsylvania for this year and 2020.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, as most of our listeners know who have followed this issue, decided that it was the map was gerrymandered, and that they wanted suggestions from Republican majority in the legislature and the governor's office, but then they went to their own expert and redrew the map. There are a lot of Republicans who feel that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania overstepped their responsibility. What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that question legally, but they did the right thing because it had to be done. Now, other states, the state Supreme Courts have done it. I know in Florida they did it because the state legislature wouldn't come up with a plan. So if the legislature won't act, somebody will. And this is an area that's going to take a lot more attention from the public. But I think the Supreme Court did the right thing. It's very audacious because they don't rely on the federal Supreme Court, the federal law, the federal constitution at all. It's purely state law. Now, that doesn't mean we couldn't have federal law applicable here. But it hasn't, until the Supreme Court acts on those cases that are referred back to the district court, it's not going to happen. So that's why I have this book out, and I hope people will read it for that reason. Scott, I also want to say that I'm going to have a book signing at the Midtown Scholar on July 14th and Saturday, 1 to 3, and also at the Hershey Library the following Wednesday, the 18th at 6:30.
You may have some people want to talk to you about this issue.
Well, I'll be glad to talk. Anyone wants to show up, I'll be glad to talk to them, whether they buy a book or not. I'll be glad to. I hope they'll buy one, but if not, I'll still talk to them and answer questions.
Former State Senator Franklin Currie, author of the new book, Gerrymandering, A Guide to Congressional Redistricting, Dark Money in the Supreme Court. Senator, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Delighted.